Constitution won't stop progressives. Why would passing another law? But they had no choice. The politicians who for decades repeatedly chastised those who worried about the government confiscating guns as conspiracy theorists got caught in their own lie. So they did what politicians do best. They tried to cover it up. They needed to deflate the fear and the anger in those who realized that they had just witnessed the Constitution being shredded. So they passed a law and said, "See, now we can't take your guns even if we wanted to. There's a law that stops us." Unfortunately, the law doesn't mean much to progressives because they answer to a higher moral authority. Their every action is rationalized by their belief that the experts know best and that their understanding of the greater good always trumps your individual rights. Always. When the progressives look at the Second Amendment, they don't see an individual right to bear arms. They see a collective right under a militia organized by the state. While they'll rarely admit it overtly, their constant erecting of barricades to individual gun ownership indicates their real agenda. For decades, the progressives have tried to restrict the rights of individuals to hold, possess, and use firearms. But the American people have successfully rejected most of those attempts, and fortunately, the mindset seems to have been turned against them. A 2008 Gallup poll found that support for handgun bans now is at its lowest since the question was first asked 51 years ago. But progressives are patient people. They move their agenda along methodically, and they never lose sight of where they want to take the country. The right to bear arms is a perfect example of that patience. Since progressives can't restrict guns outright, they've tried to do an end run. In 1997, President Clinton signed a multilateral treaty called the Inter-American Convention Against the Illicit Manufacturing of and Trafficking in Firearms, Ammunition, Explosives, and Other Related Materials Treaty. Why have you probably never heard of it? Because our system of checks and balances worked. The Senate never ratified the treaty. But now... Now, with drug violence in Mexico as the pretext, President Obama has resurrected the treaty and is urging the Senate to ratify it. Progressives like Obama don't let the law or facts slow them down in their attempts to do good. So, during a recent visit to Mexico, the president proclaimed, quote, "This war is being waged with guns purchased not here but in the United States. More than 90% of the guns recovered in Mexico come from the United States," end quote. Wow, that is a compelling statistic. 90% of the guns being trafficked are from the United States? Quick, we need to do something. There's only one problem. That figure is wrong. The truth is that 90% of the guns that are returned to the United States by Mexico originally came from America. But nobody knows how many guns aren't returned or how Mexico decides which guns to return, two important factors that skew the data. Other independent research suggests that anywhere from 17 to 36% of guns found at Mexican crime scenes can be traced back to the United States. Unfortunately, for those trying to promote an agenda, such as an international firearms treaty, 36% doesn't sound nearly as convincing as 90%, so that number is just ignored. Since President Obama and other progressive politicians have come into power, gun and ammunition sales have soared. Is that justified? I don't know. But, based on previous attempts to restrict our rights, you certainly can't fault people for being cautious. After all, what most of the experts in both politics and the media don't understand is that just because a gun is bought doesn't mean that it has to be used. Believe it or not, exercising a right is mutually exclusive from breaking the law. I want to propose a new American trust indicator. When the sales of guns and bullets go down, it means the American people once again have more trust in their government. When those sales rise, it means their trust in the government to protect them and their property is falling. It's just common sense, right? Enemies within. Tread carefully. Countless pages of print and hours of television time have been dedicated to covering the economic crisis. But there is something deeper and deadlier taking place that is not being reported on. An increasingly pervasive disenfranchisement among middle-class America. During the good times, Americans tolerated our politicians' malfeasance, lies, and corruption, which have weakened our families and country. But now, worsening economic conditions and a Congress filled with hypocrites are trying the patience of a restless population that has played by the rules. If our leaders want to address the growing disdain, they need to first restore trust with the American people. If you promise that you're going to build a fence on our southern border, build a fence. If you say you're going to clean up the government, don't appoint tax cheats to positions of power. If you promise to make America energy independent, don't refuse to discuss offshore drilling or nuclear power. If you don't know what needs to be done to fix our economic meltdown, don't spend trillions of dollars, take control of private companies, vilify corporate executives, and tell us that everything will be okay. Common sense tells us that the public will lose faith in any government where 66% of the people have absolutely no trust or not very much trust in the government's ability to manage its finances reasonably. Logic tells us that when only 22% of a citizenry trust the government to do what's right most of the time, something has to give. But the progressives won't give because they, along with their useful idiots, don't think like you. They are part of the 7% of Americans that a Rasmussen survey recently defined as the political class who trust judgment of political leaders more than the American public, reject the notion that government is a special interest group primarily watching out for itself, and believe that big business and big government work together for the interests of the investors and consumers. Given the beliefs of that group, is it any wonder that while 51% of all Americans have a favorable view of the nationwide tea parties, and another 32% have a very favorable view, a full 81% of those who identify themselves as part of the political class have either an unfavorable or highly unfavorable view. Look, they just don't see the world the same way. And they are working to make sure that you and your children succumb to their views. You feel like they're talking down to you. And you feel that way because they are talking down to you. They not only believe that they have the answer, bigger government, but theirs is also the only answer. If you feel the condescension of the political and media elite, you have Walter Lippmann to thank. Mr. Lippmann was a highly influential journalist and progressive during the Wilson and Roosevelt administrations who argued that the media should play a role as an intermediary between politicians and a public too self-centered and uneducated to really grasp what was really going on. He was noted to have remarked that most people were mentally children or barbarians, and needed self-anointed experts to help them navigate through the issues and decisions that they would be called upon as citizens to make. Every time you hear a politician explain a vote to the American public by saying, "This was a very complex issue," or "This was a nuanced bill," then skip the part where they explain that alleged complexity or nuance. You're seeing a living example of Lippmann's philosophy. It's the politician's politically correct way of saying, "You just wouldn't understand." By dismissing the average American as uninterested in the issues or not smart enough to understand them, the political class is breeding disenfranchisement and resentment. The only way out is by restoring America's confidence. We need leaders who will say what they mean and mean what they say. Leaders who will tell the American people what their convictions are, not what they think we want to hear. Honesty may not sound great in cable news soundbites, but it'll sound great to the millions of people who've been craving it. We'll have your back. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, self-described socialist. He doesn't hide from his views. He makes no apologies for his policies. For that, I respect him deeply. I would much rather have a country filled with honest brokers whose policies I abhor than one filled with people who say what I want to hear, but then do exactly the opposite. Being honest about your principles means that there can be real debate on the issues, with the chance of real progress being made. It's not just the political class who has mastered this art of deception. There are other potentially deadly masters who will seek to exploit your frustration and sense of desperation. Many will warn you of government tyranny. They'll talk of secret societies, vast conspiracies, shadow governments, and the need for violent action. I urge you, stay away from these individuals and these ideas. There is no star chamber that needs to be found and destroyed. There is no global conspiracy playing out. The individuals and groups that propagate those lies have their own agendas. But like all radicals and revolutionaries, they will eventually seek to impose their rules and their lifestyle on all of us. Make no mistake. A revolution is required to restore America. But it is a revolution that can be fought with the weapons of democracy. This is not a call to arms or violence. It is a call to once again tether ourselves to our core principles and values. Treachery and treason abound from those who profess allegiance to America. Truth, the first casualty in war, is in short supply. Make it your pole star. Objective reason and innate common sense tell us that loyalty to government either comes voluntarily due to the respect its citizens give it for a job well done, or involuntarily through threats of force or outright fear. The polling data discussed earlier makes it clear our government is quickly moving towards the latter. This is an unsustainable shift. Like our parents and our grandparents, most of us grew up in an era when our schools sought to instill confidence and respect in our government and our leaders. We learned of the selflessness of George Washington, the honesty of Abraham Lincoln, and the sacrifice Americans made to turn a group of 13 colonies into the United States of America. We learned how our country came together and crushed Nazism and fascism, and then put a man on the moon. The knowledge of those events and our government's proud role in them inspired generation after generation of Americans. But we are losing the next generation to an educational system that has fallen prey to political patronage and the progressive agenda. History, reading, writing, and math are secondary to the incessant indoctrination of our kids to climate change, the evils of capitalism, and the benefits of big government. This works as a general anesthesia, numbing our children and rendering them defenseless to the lessons and ideas that we work so hard to inoculate them from in our own homes. Given the importance of education in shaping the future of America, it's not surprising that it has been a main target of the progressive movement's agenda. During the early 1900s, progressives increased the mandatory nature of education, which resulted in enrollment for elementary and high school-aged children going up, right along with public school spending. But getting more kids into the classroom didn't matter, unless progressives could also influence what was being taught in those classrooms. Woodrow Wilson, then the president of Princeton University, candidly explained, quote, "Our problem is not merely to help students adjust themselves to world life, but to make them as unlike their fathers as we can," end quote. Progressives didn't want learning to be from teachers to students. They wanted it to be based on the children's own experiences and feelings. They wanted to develop a structure where children were equal participants with their teachers in a classroom community. But it hasn't worked. Consider that only 34.6% of the kids in Baltimore City public school system received a high school diploma in 2004. The Indianapolis public school system handed out diplomas to just 30.5% of its students. Detroit's public school system struggled to have 25% of its students qualify for a high school diploma. 45.2% of New York City public school kids graduated, with a high school diploma. Yet, despite these sobering statistics, progressives still don't view parents as partners in the learning cycle. They view them as obstacles. Parents with rigid views of test scores and report cards hold their children back from realizing their full potential, value, and role in the greater community. And once again, we find parallels to that kind of thinking in history. In the 1700s, French revolutionary Maximilien Robespierre wanted all children to be nurtured and taught by the state. In the 1900s, Hitler told his supporters that those opposing the Third Reich and its ideologies were destined to fail because, as he put it, "Your child belongs to us already, and that child will only grow up to know the new camp in which he is being raised." More recently, Hillary Clinton, who once said, quote, "I consider myself a modern progressive," pronounced that it takes a village to raise a child, suggesting that the community has a vested interest in deciding what each child is taught and how he or she is raised. Clinton and other progressives truly believe that, quote, "there really isn't any such thing as someone else's child," end quote. Because so much of what the progressives stand for feels good, it wasn't a hard sell to educators and sociologist experts. They bought into the classroom community concept and urged our teachers to act as friends to children. As a result, kids have been taught for years that they're all equals in the classroom and that feelings matter more than test scores. As those kids make their way into the workforce, we will see those new ideals influence American business. If competitiveness and hard work never mattered in the classroom, it won't matter in their jobs either. But even as these policies degrade America's standing in the world, progressives are still pushing forward. It's not enough to have moved the educational responsibility from the local community to the state and then to the federal government, but now they want to move it to the global level. The United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, which has been ratified by every UN member except the United States and Somalia, requires that countries give children certain rights, including access to education and health care, programs that develop their personalities and talents, and the opportunity to grow and develop in an atmosphere of peace, dignity, tolerance, freedom, equality, and solidarity. As the treaty itself says, quote, "by agreeing to undertake the obligations of the convention, by ratifying or acceding to it, national governments have committed themselves to protecting and ensuring children's rights, and they have agreed to hold themselves accountable for this commitment before the international community," end quote. Answering to the international community is exactly where the progressives have been trying to push us, and it is why there are once again calls in Congress for the United States to adopt this convention. Just as was the case after we refused to ratify the Kyoto Treaty, we are told that America is out of step with the rest of the world that is progressing while we stick to our outdated principles. The truth is that all of these attempts to take care of your children are nothing more than an effort to break down the cohesion and structure of the parent-child relationship while also migrating power to a national or global entity. The progressives recognize that family is the basic, most fundamental building block of society, and they realize that by degrading the power of the parents, they are establishing in the minds of children the power and compassion of the state. Examples of this can already be found. Your child doesn't have to tell you when they're using school-distributed contraceptives, seeing a school nurse, or even scheduling an abortion. The parents are effectively left out of these life-changing and emotionally demanding decisions as the state happily steps in as their surrogate. For those who continue to fight and resist, the government is watching. It doesn't matter if common sense or even if facts are on your side. If something goes against the progressive agenda, it will be targeted. Consider the Washington, D.C. school voucher program, for instance. It didn't matter to the political elite and their union allies that the kids using that program were scoring substantially higher than their public school counterparts, or that 8,000 students desperate to escape the public schools applied for just 1,714 scholarships. or that the $7,500 voucher provided cost half as much as the district would pay for that same child to attend a public school. It didn't matter because charter schools put a wall between government and education, and that wall cannot stand. So neither could the D.C. voucher program. Despite a swelling budget that seemed to fund every possible program, the Obama administration killed the voucher program by refusing to allow any new children into it. It's expected the program will die a slow, silent death. In the eyes of the education experts, it's better that children attend failing, miserable, unsafe public schools overseen by the government than have a chance at something better in a facility with less government control. Such is the power and contempt of our leaders. Homeschooling is another area that progressives target simply because the government does not get a seat at the kitchen table. Progressives label those who homeschool their children as backwards, socially undeveloped, or religious zealots. But those attacks are just diversions from their real concern about the lack of state control. You may scoff and figure that homeschooling attacks, like infringements on the right to bear arms, will never succeed. But you're wrong. It was just a few years ago that a California appellate court found that parents, quote, do not have a constitutional right to homeschool their children, end quote, under California law. The basis for their decision, quote, a primary purpose of the educational system is to train school children in good citizenship, patriotism, and loyalty to the state and nation as a means of protecting the public welfare. Apparently, the court determined that patriotism and loyalty to the state couldn't be guaranteed in a home setting. Many will counter that this decision was reversed and that homeschooling is alive and well in California today. And while that may be true, I would remind you that progressive policymakers are patient. They know how to bide their time, waiting for the right combination of public opinion and judicial appointees to take hold before making their case again. And if that fails, they will move their battle to the international level by seeking to have their version of what's best for your children dictated by the United Nations through treaties such as the Convention on the Rights of the Child. Progressives do not care about minor setbacks. They will continue their assault because they do not fear us. And truthfully, they have no reason to. We have failed to stand up to them time and time again, even as they work tirelessly and openly to restructure and reshape America. Common sense tells you that if the government was willing to bring its power and its might to prevent another 1,700 poor children from getting a school voucher in Washington, D.C., they will work even harder to bring a million homeschooled children into public schools so that loyalty to the state and the nation as a means of protecting the public welfare can be taught appropriately. For too long, we have believed the idea sold to us by politicians and bureaucrats that money is the answer to the problems with our education system. It is not. The answer is standing against the progressive policies that have led us to this destruction. We do not need more money. We just need more teachers who care, more politicians who are willing to do the right thing, more parents who are willing to fight for a return to the traditional parent-teacher relationship, and most of all, fewer professional bureaucrats standing in the way of common sense reform. Only a moral and religious people. The false idea that money can solve any problem isn't confined to education. We all started to believe that notion. If we didn't have the money, we acted like we did. We felt like we deserved to have it all. Big homes, big cars, big TVs. Even as our families became smaller, our homes got bigger. With the average home size growing from 983 square feet in 1950 to 2,512 square feet today. Naturally, those bigger homes came with a bigger price. The median home price went from $65,087, adjusted for inflation, to $165,400 over that same 58-year period. It's a sad contradiction, but our homes now seem to have plenty of room for everything except God. New technology makes us more efficient at work, but we spend less time with our children. The internet has made the world smaller, yet we're more disconnected from our communities than ever before. Yet, despite it all, we eagerly line up for more. Tennis great Arthur Ashe described what happened to our communities back during the Los Angeles riots in 1992. He said, quote, "I felt sick. That's not us. We were once a people of dignity and morality. We wanted the world to be fair to us, and we tried on the whole to be fair to the world. Now I was looking at a new order that is based squarely on revenge, not justice, with morality discarded. Instead of settling on what was right or just or moral, the idea is to get even." End quote. The truth that many people are now learning the hard way is that money isn't the solution to our problems. We are. Good families require good parents. Good communities require good neighbors. And good governments require good citizens. We have always been a nation who selflessly sacrifices for our families, our communities, and our country. But today, we're experiencing a change in what it means to be a volunteer. Under President Obama, the AmeriCorps program purports to be a volunteer organization dedicated to service. Each participant, however, is paid a monthly stipend adding up to several thousands of dollars annually. Service also comes with an award that helps defray the cost of college, another benefit worth thousands of dollars annually. Common sense tells us that if you're paid for work, you're an employee or a contractor, not a volunteer. While this subtle change may seem harmless, it reflects the progressive mindset that it is more important to get the youth involved in the AmeriCorps program than it is for them to experience the selflessness that actual volunteer work is really all about. The reason is that progressives are trying to redefine service, volunteerism, and charity in an attempt to further combine the secular with the spiritual. They want to erase any barrier between government-sanctioned work and government-sanctioned volunteerism. To them, it's all really one and the same. At this time of great need for values such as goodness, virtue, and modesty, religion is increasingly being targeted as the barrier instead of being embraced as a savior. This lie needs to be rejected, not by words, but by example. Religion is not the cause of intolerance any more than the lack of it is the cause of mass murder. People are responsible for their own behavior. Those who kill in the name of any religion are just as delusional as those who, like Stalin and Hitler, kill for no one but themselves. So why is religion so important to the proper functioning of a democracy? Well, once again, our founders had the answer. In a letter to the president of Yale University, Ben Franklin once wrote, "Here is my creed. I believe in one God, the creator of the universe, that he governs it by his providence, that he ought to be worshipped, that the most acceptable service we render to him is in doing good to his other children, that the soul of man is immortal and will be treated with justice in another life, respecting its conduct in this. These I take to be the fundamental points in all sound religion." But it wasn't about any one particular creed, dogma, or church, but rather about all religions that inspired men to selflessness, virtue, and godliness. Our founders understood the thing that we try so hard to forget today, that there is far more that unites us than divides us. Virtue, honesty, and character aren't the purview of any particular congregation. They can be found in any church, mosque, or synagogue that has God as its foundation. We have forgotten this lesson, and instead of using religion as our anchor, we use it to shame or blame. Too many in this country, those who attend church regularly, aren't pillars of their community. They're freaks or extremists. But that mindset can be changed by setting an example of tolerance and unparalleled acceptance towards each other. Let's stop using our religious symbols to score political points. Are we that insecure in our own faith that religious symbols or public prayers of a different religion cannot be welcomed with open arms? Thomas Jefferson once said, "Question with boldness even the existence of a God, because if there be one, he must more approve of the homage of reason than that of blindfolded fear." Do not be frightened from this inquiry, from any fear of its consequences. If it ends in the belief that there is no God, you will find incitements to virtue in the comfort and pleasantness you feel in its exercise. Religions and their followers must stop turning on each other. We are a land founded through divine providence, a land where, as James Madison said, the spirit of liberty and patriotism animates all degrees and denominations of men. But progressives just don't see it that way. They want us at each other's throats because a house divided cannot stand against them. They recognize that religion is a unifying force and a counterbalance to state power, so they believe that it must either be harnessed by the state or destroyed. There cannot be a rival for Americans' allegiance. As with the other issues we've covered, progressives recognize that they cannot change this overnight. They understand the powerful role that religion plays, and so they won't come out and directly repudiate it. Instead, they'll seek to co-opt its doctrines where they can, much as Woodrow Wilson did when he pronounced, quote, "There is no higher religion than human service. To work for the common good is the greatest creed," end quote. His Republican predecessor, Theodore Roosevelt, claimed that when the people voted on who should be their president, the process should be treated as next to the voice of God, end quote. But substituting the common good for God as the highest form of religion, they are subtly saying that your rights, freedoms, and liberties come from government instead of, as the Founding Fathers taught, directly from God, and that you can lend some of those rights to the government. French progressive Jean-Jacques Rousseau argued that religion and politics should be aligned in their goals and aspirations for the community. Allegiance to one should automatically trigger allegiance to the other. But it's more than simply invoking the name of God or religion. It is the devout belief that the work of government is furthering the work of God. The concept of a social gospel is not something reserved for history. At this year's National Prayer Breakfast, President Obama shared that his religious conversion took place while doing community organizing work on the streets of Chicago. Now, there's nothing wrong with that, but it shows that, for Obama, community organizing wasn't just a political endeavor, it was a spiritual one as well. So when Obama called for Americans to, quote, "treat with dignity and respect those with whom we share a brief moment on this earth," end quote, something he called the Golden Rule, it's likely that he looks at this as his duty to use the levers and power of government to make that happen. Evidence of that belief can be found in how our leaders look at charitable giving. Despite a six-figure salary, Vice President Joe Biden has given an average of $369 to charity each year for the last decade. Before considering his run for president, Barack Obama donated 1% of his salary to charity. Now, I'm not a person who will ever tell others how or where to spend their money, but given the progressive priorities and the way President Obama views AmeriCorps, I doubt this reflects stinginess. Instead, it likely reflects their belief that charitable giving is secondary to charitable action, something that they fulfill by promoting a greater good agenda. We must not fall into that trap. We must not become the hypocrites that our politicians already are. We cannot preach tolerance and then practice the opposite. Franklin once observed that only a virtuous people are capable of freedom. That's because democracy requires self-regulation, a virtue that those who practice greed and hate are incapable of mastering. But the cause of freedom is much too important to let those who are incapable of self-sufficiency destroy it. Remember, to us, slavery and tyranny are far-fetched concepts that history has righted. But to history, the far-fetched concept is the idea that men should be free. 6. Is it a rising or a setting sun? The time has come for a second American Revolution. Bring your passion, but leave your muskets at home. This revolution will take place in our minds and in our hearts. Instead of liberating us from a tyrannical monarchy, it will liberate us from our own tyrannical thinking. This revolution will be won when enough Americans rebel against the lies that are being told by those in power. Lies such as the idea that we can't look at the past to learn about the future, that our founding principles are outdated, or that only those in power really know what's best. The tangible result of this rebellion, the way you can show everyone that you're serious, is to leave whatever political party you currently belong to, stop donating to the faceless RNC or DNC, and start devoting your time, your energy, and, if appropriate, your dollars to the people who stand for your values. When that begins to happen, the two parties will start to panic. They need you. Independent thinkers will become the biggest special interest group in America, and the establishment will fear you. That is why they must keep us fighting one another. Fear and anger are their only defense against the citizenry educating themselves enough to see through their lies and corruption. There is a reason why it was illegal to teach a slave to read. Slave owners knew then what our two-party system knows now. An educated man will throw off the chains of bondage and demand to rule himself. Those in Washington believe that there are many sheep and no shepherds. So we must let them know, in the most unequivocal of terms, we are not sheep, we have never been sheep, we are shepherds. And if we don't soon reclaim our rightful place at the head of the flock, we will lose it forever. There are some who call for a violent revolution. I believe they are wrong. Our future does not lie down that bloody path. Once that spirit is released, it is uncontrollable, and I assure you, we will be worse off as individuals, communities, and country if we let others attempt to take us down that well-traveled road. Weapons and violence are easier to overcome than truth. The established powers can win a war of bullets, but they cannot win a war against passionate ideas. A war fought based on the rule of law, or a war rooted in values reflected by our founding documents. With that being said, make no mistake, now is the time. This is a call for action. Stand, link arm in arm. Our nation is being redefined right in front of our eyes. It is time that we have a say in what it will look like. We must draw a line in the sand and let our voices be heard loud and clear. Don't tread on me. This task is not small or for the faint of heart. While lives will not be lost, they will be destroyed and reputations will forever be tarnished. And that's okay. It is a small price to pay for victory, as history has shown that if we lose our grasp on freedom, it will likely never be enjoyed by us again. If the American experiment fails, then so does the cause of liberty, not just here, but around the world. One day, we will face our children. We will face our grandchildren as they ask us what we found more important and valuable than freedom. They will ask us if our big, unaffordable homes, free universal health care, and buy-it-now lifestyle were worth enslaving them for. How will you answer them? Just as we look back with pride and awe at what the generations did before us, to preserve the cause of freedom, our children and grandchildren will look back at us. But should we now fail, it won't be with pride or awe, it will be with disgust. As they toil under oppressive taxes and tyrannical rule, they will constantly question what we were so busy doing that we didn't notice the stripping away of our freedoms and liberties. as they are forced to carry the yoke of servitude imposed by their domestic and foreign masters, they will question why we did nothing. Did you not see it coming? They'll wonder. The choice is ours. Do we continue to lie to ourselves now, or tell our children lies later? Our freedom, liberty, and continued transformation into a better place will not come from the politicians in Washington or from the United Nations, the G20, the IMF, or any other organization. It will only come from us. Each of us stands as a sentinel against oppression, just as our ancestors have for 20 generations. There will be temporal as well as eternal consequences for each of us should we abandon this post now and let liberty's light slip away into the darkness. I said at the beginning, I think I know who you are, but that is only because I know who I am. We may not agree on everything, but we both know what is happening now just doesn't feel right. No one told us to be good to each other on 9/12. It just happened. We know that our best days aren't behind us. We know that America is the country that freed millions of people in the last 100 years alone. We are the people that changed the world. America's promise of freedom allowed the lone entrepreneur to bring the world the light bulb, the car, telephone, movie, assembly line, artificial heart, computer, bifocals, the sewing machine, the refrigerator, air conditioner, the safety pin, TV, the cash register, crayon, power tools, the oil well, the water tower, the popsicle, blue jeans, elevators, the repeating rifle, the laser, the polio vaccine, the microwave oven, copy machines, fiber optics, and cotton candy. We are only a simple change of mindset from being that nation again. As we found out on that day after tragedy, on September 12th, miracles only require a change in perspective. When we stop telling ourselves that we can't do it, that our best days are behind us, things will begin to change. Start telling yourself, I don't need the government to do it for me. Stop being a slave, and you will begin to witness miracles. The first step in recovery is to admit you have a problem. So say it. Say it. Say it out loud. We have a problem. Admit your role in it. Maybe it's, I spent too much. I didn't pay attention to the polls. I played partisan politics. I was too afraid or tired to get involved. I was too slow to remember my values and my principles, or I rationalized the decisions or choices I made. It doesn't matter. Leave the past in the past. Seize the future. That shining city on the hill, it's still there. Make no mistake, the actions you must take are simple in language, but complex in practice. They will demand your time, your attention, your resolve. Have patience, but also carry with you a sense of urgency. The clock is ticking. Assemble with passion, peace, and power. March on Washington. Let your voices be heard and your anger be seen. Some will label your words as inciting or dangerous. Help them understand that the truth will always sound angry to those who cannot recognize it. Do not wait for others to say and do the things that you feel now. The American Republic will not be swept into the dustbin of history if good men and women come forward now. Rest assured, others much more timid than you will join the fight, but they wait for a sign, they wait for action, they wait for you. Stand shoulder to shoulder and arm unafraid. Listen, learn, lead. Renew that promise first made during that hot summer in Philadelphia and mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. After the signing of the Constitution, It was 1787. Benjamin Franklin spoke of a chair belonging to General Washington. At the top of the chair were the golden rays of a sun. He told General Washington that throughout all of the proceedings, he had wondered if it was a rising or setting sun. When Washington asked him, "What have you decided, Mr. Franklin?" he didn't hesitate with his response, "It is a rising sun." I believe that is still true today. Great and powerful miracles are about to unfold before us, but only if we decide right here and right now that our sun is still rising. Once we do that, once we dedicate ourselves to the new dawn and experience a restoration of our founding principles, we can be secure in the knowledge that future generations will enjoy the same liberties and freedoms that were reserved for us. But until then, the sense that something just doesn't feel right will linger. Until an independence is declared, the continent will feel itself like a man who continues putting off some unpleasant business from day to day, yet knows it must be done, hates to set about it, wishes it over, and is continually haunted with the thoughts of its necessity. Those are the last words of Thomas Paine's call to action, and so they become the last words of mine as well. Under normal circumstances, words like those have no meaning or influence unless people give them power. But these are not normal circumstances, and those words are not just words. Those words find their roots in an idea that seems to have been all but abandoned. Common sense. A final thought to let your journey begin here. I hope this book serves as a solid starting point in your journey to learn more about your country, its history, and what needs to be done to put her back on course. But this book can only be that, a starting point. You must continue your education and learning so that you will recognize those people whose plans and policies promote personal freedom and responsibility, along with the danger signs of those whose policies will do the opposite. I have just a few books that I have read over and over again in the last 12 months that have opened my eyes. I believe two of them should be required reading. The 5,000-Year Leap is essential to understanding why our founders built this republic the way they did. And American progressivism will reveal how the country began to leave its core roots and where that pathway ultimately leads. Please, read The 5,000-Year Leap and then American Progressivism. Oh, and if you have time, you'll fall in love with our founders when you read the series The Real George Washington, The Real Thomas Jefferson, and The Real Ben Franklin. Let your journey begin here, and we'll see you online at the912project.com.
Glenn Beck's Common Sense, the case against an out-of-control government inspired by Thomas Paine, was written by Glenn Beck with Joseph Carey and read by Glenn Beck. It was recorded at Mercury Radio and CDM Studios in New York. Editing and post-production by Common Mode, Paul Fowley, Technical Director. It was mixed by Terry Hogan. Glenn Beck's Common Sense, the case against an out-of-control government inspired by Thomas Paine, was produced and directed by Karen DiMattia. I'm John Dawson. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Common Sense by Thomas Paine. Introduction. Perhaps the sentiments contained in the following pages are not yet sufficiently fashionable to procure them general favor. A long habit of not thinking a thing wrong gives it a superficial appearance of being right, and raises at first a formidable outcry in defense of custom. But tumult soon subsides. Time makes more converts than reason. As a long and violent abuse of power is generally the means of calling the right of it in question, and in matters to which might never have been thought of, had not the sufferers been aggravated into the inquiry. And as the King of England hath undertaken in his own right to support the Parliament in what he calls theirs, and as the good people of this country are grievously oppressed by the combination, they have an undoubted privilege to inquire into the pretensions of both, and equally to reject the usurpations of either. In the following sheets, the author hath studiously avoided everything which is personal among ourselves. Compliments, as well as censure to individuals, make no part thereof. The wise and the worthy need not the triumph of a pamphlet, and those whose sentiments are injudicious or unfriendly will cease of themselves, unless too much pains are bestowed upon their conversion. The cause of America is, in a great measure, the cause of all mankind. Many circumstances have and will arise which are not local, but universal, and through which the principles of all lovers of mankind are affected, and in the event of which their affections are interested. Delaying a country desolate with fire and sword, declaring war against the natural rights of all mankind, and extirpating the defenders thereof from the face of the earth, is the concern of every man to whom nature hath given the power of feeling, of which class, regardless of party censure, is the author. Philadelphia, February 14th, 1776. Of the Origin and Design of Government in General, with Concise Remarks on the English Constitution. Some writers have so confounded society with government as to leave little or no distinction between them, whereas they are not only different, but have different origins. Society is produced by our wants, and government by our wickedness. The former promotes our happiness positively by uniting our affections, the latter negatively by restraining our vices. The one encourages intercourse, the other creates distinctions. The first is a patron, the last a punisher. Society in every state is a blessing. But government, even in its best state, is but a necessary evil, in its worst state, an intolerable one. For when we suffer, or are exposed to the same miseries by a government, which we might expect in a country without government, our calamity is heightened by reflecting that we furnish the means by which we suffer. Government, like dress, is the badge of lost innocence. The palaces of kings are built on the ruins of the bowers of paradise. For were the impulses of conscience clear, uniform, and irresistibly obeyed, man would need no other lawgiver. But that not being the case, he finds it necessary to surrender up a part of his property to furnish means for the protection of the rest. And this he is induced to do by the same prudence which in every other case advises him out of two evils to choose the least. Wherefore, security being the true design and end of government, it unanswerably follows that whatever form thereof appears most likely to ensure it to us, with the least expense and greatest benefit, is preferable to all others. In order to gain a clear and just idea of the design and the end of government, let us suppose a small number of persons settled in some sequestered part of the earth, unconnected with the rest. They will then represent the first peopling of any country or of the world. In this state of natural liberty, society will be their first thought. 1,000 motives will excite them thereto. The strength of one man is so unequal to his wants, and his mind so unfitted for perpetual solitude, that he is soon obliged to seek assistance and relief of another, who in his turn requires the same. 4 or 5 united would be able to raise a tolerable dwelling in the midst of a wilderness. But one man might labor out the common period of life without accomplishing anything. When he had felled his timber, he could not remove it, nor erect it after it was removed. Hunger, in the meantime, would urge him from his work, and every different want call him a different way. Disease, nay, even misfortune, would be death, for though neither might be mortal, yet either would disable him from living,
and reduce him to a state in which he might rather be said to perish than to die. Thus necessity, like a gravitating power, would soon form our newly arrived immigrants into society, the reciprocal blessings of which would supersede and render the obligations of law and government unnecessary, while they remain perfectly just to each other. But as nothing but heaven is impregnable to vice, it will unavoidably happen that in proportion as they surmount the first difficulties of immigration, which bound them together in a common cause, they will begin to relax in their duty and attachment to each other. And this remissness will point out the necessity of establishing some form of government to supply the defect of moral virtue. Some convenient tree will afford them a state house, under the branches of which the whole colony may assemble to deliberate on public matters. It is more than probable that their first laws will have the title only of regulations, and be enforced by no other penalty than public disesteem. In this first parliament, every man, by natural right, will have a seat. But as the colony increases, the public concerns will increase likewise, and the distance at which the members may be separated will render it too inconvenient for all of them to meet on every occasion as at first, when their number was small, their habitations near, and the public concerns few and trifling. This will point out the convenience of their consenting to leave the legislative part to be managed by a select number, chosen from the whole body, who are supposed to have the same concerns at stake which those who have appointed them, and who will act in the same manner as the whole body would act were they present. If the colony continues increasing, it will become necessary to augment the number of the representatives, and that the interest of every part of the colony may be attended to, it will be found best to divide the whole into convenient parts, each part sending its proper number, and that the elected might never form to themselves an interest separate from the electors. Prudence will point out the propriety of having elections often, because as the elected might by that means return and mix again with the general body of the electors in a few months, their fidelity to the public will be secured by the prudent reflection of not making a rod for themselves. And as this frequent interchange will establish a common interest with every part of the community, they will mutually and naturally support each other. And on this, not on the unmeaning name of king, depends the strength of government and the happiness of the governed. Here, then, is the origin and rise of